Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. Let me introduce Oliver Hume, spelt home, but Hume, he tells me. He also told me that I'm allowed to say that he's a Prince's Risborough boy, and that's only because he and I, having a chat yesterday, found out that I live in a house not far away from where he was born and grew up. My wife and I was going to say emigrated to Prince's Risborough from St Albans, but it feels like that sometimes. So we're now living close to where he was born, and perhaps some of the wisdom might run off. Oliver is the... Come on, keep up with this. Oliver is the... He's told me I can say this too. The Bishop of Bristol's Chief of Staff. Now, I know we're into the American presidential elections, but, you know, it does sort of have a ring of that, doesn't it? And if there are stars and stripes that suddenly appear behind us, then you know why. The truth is that I emailed Bishop Mike of Bristol about 9 or 10 months ago, and he replied saying he would love to come, but unfortunately, typical bishop again, unfortunately he wouldn't be able to come because he was going to be away this weekend. However, you ought to get in touch with Oliver Hume because he actually tells me how to run the diocese anyway. So we're very fortunate to have the guy who really runs Bristol Diocese and who's going to tell us, I hope, how to think outside the box. Oliver, is that good enough?
That's brilliant.
Thanks, Robin, and thank you for still inviting me, even though I was probably the monkey organ grinder. It also springs to mind. Brilliant. It's good to be here with you and to talk about a subject which we spend a lot of time thinking and hopefully doing something about in the diocese. The folklore goes in the Diocese of Bristol that in March 2006, the Bishop of Bristol sacked all 7 area deans. I had the rather dubious pleasure of attending the meeting in which this ruthless act of pastoral insensitivity was accomplished. And all I can say is that the journalists of the diocese wrote the headline rather than the text of the article. Just to give a bit of background, what had happened was that the bishop's staff had made the decision to increase significantly the responsibilities held at deanery level, handing over some of their responsibilities to area deans and lay chairs. Now, those responsibilities represented a role and an expectation of a commitment that the existing area deans had not signed up for when they had put themselves forward, or were put forward, as an area dean. So it would have kind of defeated the object of kind of scaling the job up to ask that group of area deans to just step up to the new job. So the bishop, in fact, asked them all to step down, holding out the olive branch that, if they so wanted, they could apply again for the position. Now, I won't pretend that that meeting was all sweetness and light. It was really rather tense and awkward. And the reality is that only one of them did apply for the new role, and he didn't get appointed. And there were a few clergy colleagues, understandably, licking their wounds around the diocese for a few months. But this folklore, or that headline, has served a purpose in the kind of cultural history of the diocese. That act was seen as a decisive and defining moment when the senior leadership in the diocese showed that they intended to take deanery seriously. And that's the journey that we've been on in the last 6 years or so. And it's that journey that I'm going to talk about maybe for the next half an hour or so. The title I've been given is Thinking Out of the Box, Achievements, Innovation and Capacity Building in the Diocese of Bristol. Now, I hope occasionally we have thought out of the box. I hope we've bred some innovation, built some capacity, and hopefully achieved a thing or two. And hopefully through the story I tell, some of that will come out. Using Bishop Peter's very arresting image, hopefully some fleas jump higher than the lid. But I don't think anything that we've done hasn't been done in some diocese or other over the last 10 or 20 years, although perhaps our combination of what the things we've done might have been different. But what I really want to do through recounting this journey is to highlight some of the challenges, issues, and tensions we've had to address and manage, and talk about some of the lessons that we're learning. I want to stress now, as Bishop Peter did, that this has not all been progress, and we've made a lot of mistakes along the way. But I think we are on a similar journey to that of many other dioceses and their deaneries. Some are further ahead of us and have some scars we could have perhaps learnt from. Some are starting out, and I hope that some of what I share will help prepare you for the journey that you're embarking on. Certainly I've learnt some things in the last 24 hours in terms of the journey we're on. And once I've told the story and explored some of these issues, we'll have some time for group discussion and then some feedback and Q&A. So just before I go on, a little bit more background about me, after Robin's lovely introduction. I've worked in the Diocese of Bristol for 7 years. I came first as effectively the bishop's lay chaplain and a sort of strategic development advisor to work with the bishop's staff on strategic planning. And for the last 3 years as the bishop's chief of staff, which is a kind of, it's basically a posh way of saying I've fulfilled three roles in the diocese: bishop's chaplain, director of communications, and heading up the kind of strategic planning and policy. Throughout that 7 years, I've had the privilege and the kind of daunting task of being part of the bishop's staff and all that that brings with it. Just my professional background before that was in book publishing, in marketing, and in business development for a large commercial publishing group, as well as just before we moved to Bristol from London, self-supporting ministry role in the parish we're part of in South London. In the rest of my life, I'm married to Sonia. We have three young children: Seth, who's 5, Micah, who's 3, and Isla, who is 5 months old. We love being part of the parish of Bishopston and St Andrews in Bristol, which is part of the great city deanery in Bristol, and we worship in our local church there, St Bart's. But let me stress that because of my diocesan role, I've resolved not to get involved in PCCs or deanery synods, although in a former life I have been a church warden. So a health warning, that what I say comes very much from a diocesan perspective. And that's a partial perspective, and I hope you'll kind of bear with me and be gracious with me if I err too much in that direction. But that's where I'm coming from when I talk about deaneries. Just to give you a picture of the Diocese of Bristol, it's basically an M4 corridor, or Great Western Line diocese. It follows them both from Swindon to Bristol, taking in parts of North Wiltshire and South Gloucestershire, and ending up at the Severn Bridge. These are our 204, maybe, churches. And you get a sense of the spread. The population is about 1 million people, mostly in Greater Bristol, where 500,000 people live, and Swindon, where 250,000 people live. In the real world, Swindon and Bristol have no particular common ground or relationship, other than a vaguely antagonistic one. And the more rural areas would probably rather go shopping in Bath. Bath and Wells. In terms of our church makeup, we have about 200 churches in 100 or so benefices, and 30,000 or so people regularly attend church in the diocese, with an average weekly attendance of 18,000 in 2010. We still don't know 2011. Looking at clergy licensed to parishes, including training curates, and if our vacancies were filled, which they're not, we'd have about 125 stipendiary clergy and 75 non-stipendiary or self-supporting clergy, as we call them. In all, parishes in the diocese raise about £15 million. The diocesan budget is £7.5 million. £5 million or so of that comes from parishes in parish share. And our deaneries, well, we have 7 in all, of varying sizes and in varying contexts. 1 for Swindon, 4 for Greater Bristol, including the rural parts of South Gloucestershire, and two rural deaneries in North Wiltshire. The deanery with the most churches is North Wiltshire Deanery, north of the M4, but it has the smallest population and a church-going community. Bristol West has the fewest churches, the most money, and the most members. I think about 15 years ago, pastoral reorganisation reduced our deaneries from 14 to 7 or something along those lines. Needless to say, they are all sufficiently different and keep reminding us of that. So that's the potted summary of where and what we are. But what are we about? Well, like most dioceses these days, we have purpose and mission statements, strategies and programs. I can be held responsible for a lot of that. And there's a fair amount of cynicism about any and all of these. It's important to refer to these, and I will when talking about the responsibilities that held at Deanery 11. But to be clear, what we're primarily about is supporting parish churches through setting a direction for the diocese that focuses on the mission of God and the growth of his kingdom, recruiting, developing, and deploying godly ministers who can lead their churches into growth, providing resources, governance, and decision-making processes that facilitate mission and growth locally, and being that wider community of faith where we can work and share together and be interdependent. That's a key word for us, where we're bigger than the sum of our parts. Now, these are the filters through which we try to allocate resources, assess our work, and make decisions. This is effectively why we kind of feel we exist, which takes us back to March 2006 and the P45 moment for our area deans. What led to that decision? Well, in Mike Hill, the Bishop of Bristol, we have a diocesan bishop who's been at the vanguard, really, of deaneries taking on extra responsibility. Between 1988 and 1992, he was the rural dean of Amersham, one of the wealthiest deaneries in the diocese of Oxford. I know there are representatives here from Amersham. And he started exploring what could be done together, initially through sharing each other's parish share burdens. As Archdeacon of Berkshire in the mid-1990s, he developed the strategy in the Diocese of Oxford whereby deaneries took on more responsibility in a number of areas. He oversaw that work in the Episcopal area of Buckingham, where he was an area bishop from 1998 to 2003. He moved to Bristol, and by 2006, Lee Rayfield, who was appointed the bishop, no, in 2005, I should say, the bishop of Swindon, Bishop Lee had worked through the reality of that deanery strategy in Oxford, where he had been area dean of Maidenhead. So no one should have been surprised that deaneries were about to get a shake-up in the Diocese of Bristol. I asked Bishop Mike about it yesterday, you know, the kind of history leading up to it, and he admitted to being a bit of a one-trick pony in relation to strategy and deaneries. I didn't give him the satisfaction of contradicting him, but I can assure you he is not a one-trick pony strategically. It was Bishop Mike's conviction that too many decisions in dioceses were taken too far from the coalface. Bishop's staffs hover at something between kind of helicopter altitude and light aircraft and miss the lie of the land, just sometimes. It's easy for anecdote and personal judgments to determine some decision-making rather than good working knowledge. We wanted to introduce a kind of balcony view rather than the aerial view. And whatever the limitations of the deaneries as a perspective, it's the structure we've got. So let's make use of it. This was the organising principle of subsidiarity, which I've got up there, which states that a matter ought to be handled by the smallest, lowest, or least centralised authority capable of addressing that matter effectively. That's according to Wikipedia, at least. And he was trying to apply that to the oversight of the diocese. The other core factor in making the decision to share responsibility with deaneries was to increase the level of interdependence, that word I mentioned, in the life of the diocese.
the us and them attitude between parishes and their diocese, and vice versa, doesn't help mission. It breeds on one level dependency, and on another level distance and mistrust. By bringing the life of the diocese closer to home through deanery relationships, the aim was to play a part in increasing the sense of playing a part in something bigger, experiencing the wider life of the diocese through the deanery. So the deanery is us rather than them. It's in the deanery that you encounter your neighbours, seeking to minister to communities that you know, that you drive through, that you walk through, that sometimes, but not always, have something in common with yours and can be that kind of conversational space that Bishop Alistair talked about last night. So that was the kind of broad thinking behind this decision. And that decision in 2006 led immediately to a couple of changes. Firstly, the leadership quality of the area deans increased markedly, if not uniformly. A role description, what else was devised, clergy were invited to apply, and the bishop appointed those best suited. As a result, but again not uniformly, the kind of leadership gifts that area deans brought became more strategic and ideas and decision-making oriented, rather than the previous leadership, which had been good, pastoral, more representational leadership. Secondly, it led to increased expectation of area deans and lay chairs. A budget of, wait for it, £10,000 per year was given to each area dean to ensure that they were sufficiently resourced for a role which it was expected they would give 2 days a week to. Their stipend was also enhanced by £1,000 a year. But with the increased expectations of deanery leadership also came increased expectations on diocesan leadership to start communicating, consulting, involving deaneries to actually walk the talk. Now, my recollection is in the first 3 years between sort of 2006, 2009, 10, diocesan and deanery leadership were clearly feeling their way in this relationship. The language that was used was that of sharing episcopate, sharing responsibility, not giving or delegating them. Letting go and trust, competence and know-how were all issues for us, and I'll talk about them later. But in the areas of clergy deployment planning, encouraging mission, being consulted about decisions that deaneries had never before had a look in on, things were changing. It was an important developmental period during which the quality and commitment of lay chairs improved as elections came up, and as some area deans changed jobs, other clergy who may not have believed back in 2006 that the diocese was serious about sharing responsibility and the deanery synod was even worth turning up to, or even chapter, they started to take notice and put themselves forward as area deans. The second shift took place, at least in theory, in 2009, when we put forward and agreed our 2010-15 diocesan strategy, releasing the energy. Behind the strategy was the aim to release the energy and potential of the whole people of God, release the energy and potential of our resources as a diocese, and ultimately to see that potential burst into the life of the kingdom of God. At the forefront of our strategy was our diocesan growth program. We launched this in 2005, and it's really a framework to encourage parishes to grow in commitment to God, to grow in partnership with others within and beyond the church, to grow in influence in their communities, and of course to grow in numbers. Like the Bath and Wells Changing Lives initiative, we've stuck with it, and I think we will, at least until 2020, maybe beyond. Along with our purpose statement of creating communities of wholeness with Christ at the centre, the growth programme is meant to set the direction of the life of the diocese. They're both meant to be permissive and encouraging to parishes. And the reason to have this is to show parishes that are committed to God's mission, that their diocese and their bishops are behind them, and to help parishes who are struggling to focus on God's mission to start focusing on them and what God wants for the world where they are. The second strand of the strategy and the way that the diocese would give energy to this growth was by developing its ministers and leaders. It's really the core activity of the diocese. And Bishop Peter talked about what they do in Bath and Wells. And this is really where we too are putting most of our resources, not just in terms of paying and housing clergy, but in thinking about how do we best develop our clergy and lay ministers? How do we ensure more people are coming forward and committing their lives in these ways, both within the church and beyond it? As a diocese, we'd need sufficient income to do this, but we felt that the balance of resources across the diocese needed to be corrected, with too high a proportion of parish income being redirected through the diocese and parish share. And so we have an income generation strand to our strategy. I won't go into that. And finally, the strategy addressed how such work should be supported, what central services should be available, what the governance and leadership structure should be, and a key part of that was the formalising of the deanery responsibilities that we kind of felt our way towards. But let me just stress that this strand is dictated by the growth programme, and it's in support of that. We're trying to become, to use a terrible phrase, fit for purpose to support the church we wanted to see. So, as a result of this strategy, we laid out what the responsibilities at deanery leadership level were. Area deans and lay chairs were encouraged to form deanery leadership teams, and these would have delegated responsibility for four main areas, a few other responsibilities as well. Firstly, encouraging the growth program locally in their deanery. Secondly, making recommendations about where and what kind of clergy deployment, both stipendiary and self-supporting, was appropriate in the benefices of their deaneries within the parameters of their stipendary allocation. Managing our rather exhaustive, occasionally unpopular, but increasingly effective leadership development and vacancies process. And requesting pledges from parishes and parish share under what was to be a new unassessed kind of pledge system like London's, and raising income that was then to be shared across the diocese. Now, these were clearly defined, delegated responsibilities, and for the last 3 years we have sought to put them into practice. So what issues have we faced as we sought together to make those changes? Story. Imagine a daughter who has been routinely ignored by her parents, occasionally ridiculed by them in public, and certainly thought they could never achieve anything in life. Then one day, out of the blue, her parents sit her down and tell her that they want her to step up and start managing part of the family business. How do you think that's going to work out? Well, just to make a few presumptions, I guess the daughter's going to be underconfident, inexperienced, and probably not really going to know what she's doing. But she's also going to want to test the boundaries and see if her parents are actually for real. She's likely to make some poor decisions and express some generally adolescent behaviour. The parents, on the other hand, are likely to actually forget she's meant to be running that division, frequently ignore her, occasionally overrule her. They're sometimes going to regret they made the decision in the first place because of the messes they end up feeling they need to clear up, and they're going to struggle to actually let go. In short, it's going to be messy. A dysfunctional parent-child relationship must navigate and endure a difficult parent-adolescent phase and aim to end up with an adult-to-adult mature relationship that we're so good at. That's never been a straightforward process. And in terms of the family of the Diocese of Bristol, that was the kind of thing we were trying to attempt. Area deans and deanery leadership teams have made some pretty poor decisions, but then so did the bishop's staff. Archdeacons and bishops ignored their area dean and lay chair colleagues on crucial decisions, sometimes by mistake, sometimes on purpose. Area deans made power plays, messes were made, bishops and archdeacons got upset, communication was patchy and continues to be so, says the director of communications. But after 6 years, I think there's some evidence for this, we're a lot closer to that relationship of organisational equals, fulfilling different roles and responsibilities, trusting each other a bit. So if you're considering setting out on this kind of journey, do not underestimate actually what diocesan leadership will have to let go, emotionally as well as practically, and how the ignored child of the deanery will need to step up, grow up, and get secure. Acknowledge that it will happen. Operate under the umbrella of grace, and try to be clear and open with one another. Some jargon. Decentralization, delegation, devolution, deanery. Words that have been bandied around our diocese with great abandon since we started this journey, probably with very little of understanding of what they actually mean. My personal view is that the Church of England lives the paradox of being both non-centralised and highly centralised. Parishes operate autonomously, but through a legal framework and through the levers of licensing and paying ministers over the course of the 20th century, dioceses re-centralised the structures of the church massively. And we wonder why we have an us and them culture. Where does the floppy deanery, I like that, where does the floppy deanery fit between the non-centralised parish and the centralising diocese? Well, maybe nowhere. It starts as a humble, weak link. It cannot tell any parish what to do, actually much like a diocese. And any responsibility or decision-making powers it has tend to come from the diocesan level. Any influence deanery leadership teams must have must be earned and be exercised with the permission of those they seek to lead. So to what extent does giving deaneries responsibility constitute kind of decentralization? Well, the obvious answer is to a certain extent. But in the Diocese of Bristol, we went through a period of it being to an uncertain extent, and this came largely as a result of a confusion between whether powers had been devolved to deaneries or whether responsibilities had been delegated, the difference between devolution and delegation. Some people, notably some at deanery level, but crucially the bishop staff member responsible for managing the area deans, thought that powers had been devolved to deaneries, or didn't actually think there was a difference between devolution and delegation. So having been given responsibility for deployment and income generation, this would have meant that there was no accountability framework unless things got so bad that the powers were revoked. Whereas, as I think I've said, what was clearly outlined and agreed through our strategy was a delegation of responsibilities. Delegation is not necessarily a guarded act of empowerment. It involves trust. It involves letting go. But it's also an ongoing act of collaboration with accountability and support built in. And in some ways, because of this confusion in some places, we didn't experience sort of deaneries getting all kind of power happy and all that sort of thing. They weren't taking on too much responsibility, but the negative was the exclusion of the diocesan level from a space that it could usefully and would probably rightly occupy. In some cases, the diocesan viewpoint, diocesan resources and know-how were, how should I put it, not invoked. Meanwhile, one or two deaneries were sort of starting to build up structures and bureaucracy that duplicated work that was being done to a higher standard and more cost-effectively at a diocesan level. When we set out on this journey, what we were not intending on doing, which devolution gets you close to, was creating seven dioceses with seven infrastructures. The diocesan strategy was not to make it all about deaneries. It was to enable deaneries to fulfil their best possible purpose in our view. We were seeking to delegate the responsibilities to deanery leadership that they were better placed to fulfil, but also to bring the resources at diocesan level in to support them. And in some cases, we just clearly failed to communicate or manage that well at a diocesan level. And in some cases, we've been seen as now rowing back from our commitment to deaneries. And I really don't think we're doing that. We're trying to get some clarity. But part of the problem as a result of that, and what we're learning from, is we're now combating an even greater suspicion of diocesan structures. And in recent months, we've had to restate and re-justify what does need to happen at diocesan level, where, you know, a number of things, the more strategic, larger overview, can take place. And that's inevitably having an impact on our ability to raise income for the diocese as a whole. The lesson that we're learning is that diocesan leadership need to be crystal clear and consistent with one another about what they're handing over, why, what it means, and how it will be managed. This just leads me to talk a bit about which responsibilities we felt were best delegated to deanery level. I've outlined the major responsibilities that were given to our deanery leadership, but there were others that it was decided not to give, not to share it with deanery leadership. We might have been right, we may be wrong, we might change our minds, but we've tried to work out the principle of subsidiarity in our context. So, for example, we do think that deanery leadership teams should effectively make the decision about where a post should be deployed, but we don't think it's their job to make the appointment. Yes, area deans, predominantly, sometimes lay chairs, are involved in the appointments process, but they shouldn't be promising jobs to their preferred candidates. The recruitment expertise, the process, all the legal requirements around clergy recruitment these days needs to be run at diocesan level for efficiency's sake, if nothing else. Equally, PCCs and deanery leadership teams need to be consulted about clergy housing to get that balcony view. But the management decisions relating to a £40 million asset base in our case, probably much more in other dioceses, with a £1.3 million annual expenditure budget, needs again to be done at a diocesan level. This is a lot of money we're talking about, and these are the resources of the church for mission and ministry. Another example would be that deanery chapters are proving a really effective place for peer support and encouragement towards leadership for mission, and area deans are offering some excellent pastoral support. But we've made the decision that area deans are not line managers of clergy. They do not manage professional development for clergy. They do not get involved in discipline. They do not get involved in capability. And another, just a final example, and it's brought home to me this morning around the kind of data provision. You know, in my role with the sort of more strategic planning hat on, I can sort of crunch the data of attendance and finance and mission and finance strength statistics for a diocese, for the whole diocese, almost as easily as I can do it for three parishes, and then offer that data to deanery colleagues. What's the point in them trying to find it all out, spending a lot of time with a spreadsheet, and then getting perhaps not the most effective data? These are the kinds of things that we feel are better done at diocesan level to resource and support those in deaneries. You may want to think about what responsibility it's right for you to take on in your deanery, and which is not, and the ones that it wouldn't be right to do that. So these are the responsibilities, but despite the encouraging appetite of our deanery leaders to take on these responsibilities and the kind of balcony view, as we call it, decision making, there are real challenges. Parishes will frequently criticise a diocese for top-down decision-making and approaches. Sometimes that's justified. Sometimes that's a criticism when they don't like a decision that a diocese is asked to take, balancing available resources and mission need. But when an unpopular decision is made by someone sort of flying in a helicopter, you can kind of shout, throw stones, but you don't have to look in the whites of their eyes for very long. When someone makes it from the balcony, you do. And you continue to do so from week to week. Making decisions with a deanery hat on from the balcony is one thing, but it's hard when you're the vicar of the neighbouring parish to that affected and you see them on the street day by day. It's quite useful to be able to deflect the heat of a decision or a conflict to the bishop or the archdeacon or the diocesan secretary sometimes. And inevitably, this has swayed some of our deanery leaders in their decision making. It's really tough, and you've got to be really tough. But what can happen is that the deanery can become a robust and challenging space where good decision-making and judgment can be exercised, and I think we were talking a bit about that last night, and then lived out. How much better would that be in the long run than using distance as a tactic for diffusing anger? Because it doesn't really diffuse it, it just sends it undercover. Capacity building. How have we sought to build capacity in deaneries? This is actually part of the title, so I should speak about it. I really think that the key to this has been giving real responsibility. If you want energy to be created at a deanery level, make sure they have a real job to do. I talked about this in relation to area dean and lay chairs, but the same applies to members of our deanery leadership teams, which are often now the same group as our deanery standing committees or pastoral committees. One of the changes of emphases that we made in our 2010-15 strategy was to focus on deanery leadership teams rather than just area deans and lay chairs as we had previously. Of course, there's a level of direct accountability running through the appointed area dean in relation to their responsibilities and the lay chair who's elected. But in all of our deaneries, there's now a group of gifted and committed lay and ordained people working collaboratively, on the various areas given to the deaneries, and they're taking the initiative. And on the whole, these aren't sort of committees. They are actually teams focused on encouraging mission, sharing and generating resources, and making wise decisions on how those resources can and should be used. The budget, the £10,000, is not hopefully now seen as area dean's expenses, but as a deanery budget. And gradually, some people are even standing for deanery synod, not to get a free pass onto their PCC, but to contribute to a lively conversation about mission in the deanery synod and how it's resourced, and to get in on the meaningful decisions where they are. Part of the capacity building obviously relates to the role of Ariel Rural Dean. And it's been hard to get the balance of trying to encourage team leadership, the sort of thing I've just been talking about, with a mix of lay and ordained roles, but also recognise that the area dean is an appointed leader and manager who's given a job to do and is ultimately held accountable for decisions in their deanery. By bigging up the role of area dean in 2006, and given the particularly clerical culture of the diocese historically, I'm sure that's not unique to us, but I think many would recognise we had a particularly clerical culture, we were always in a place where the balance tipped towards, you know, it's the area dean, stupid. There was also a kind of parochialism within the diocese that led people in the diocese to kind of think that we were somehow blazing a trail by sharing responsibility with deaneries, and we were somehow asking more of our area deans than any other diocese had ever done. The reality was that we weren't. There were other dioceses who had asked their area deans to do much similar things for many years before, but we were resourcing them better. Many used the budget for administrative help, in the parish and deanery, and one or two have used their allocation of parochial posts within the deanery to help free them up for more area dean time. Now, a few of our area deans, particularly in around 2009-10, were making quite strong arguments to be half-time posts, and some of them do spend up to half their time fulfilling their responsibilities. And when that initial five-year term came to an end last year, as a bishop's staff and with area deans, we thought long and hard about whether to change the basis of appointment. They'd initially been appointed for 3 years with the option to renew for a further 2 years. Now, a number of factors came into play when we were considering this, particularly, and we were considering this in light of clergy terms of service that had just come into effect or was just coming into effect. And our concern was that area deans were able to fulfil the additional role for long enough to make a difference, but also have the opportunity to let go of it at the right time of their ministry without jeopardising their parochial role. We saw it as a good leadership development opportunity for our clergy, some of whom may be considered as archdeacons or bishops or deans or vicars of large churches in the future. We wanted there to be an incentive for clergy in a deanery to aspire to the role and be able to put themselves forward in due course. And despite the limitations in terms of available clergy in some deaneries, we wanted to develop our own clergy who had peer support in their deaneries rather than recruit to the role from outside. And different views were expressed on all of those issues, but that was ultimately the decision was made. And actually, the limitations of that are clearly evident in our diocese. At the moment, all of our seven area deans are men. This isn't what we want, and it certainly doesn't look good. It wasn't always the case, and we do have an equal balance of male-female lay chairs. We would love more of our women clergy to want to fulfil this role. So what we decided late 2010, early 2011, was that our area dean role would be, in technical terms, an additional responsibility for a period of 3 years, again with an option to renew for a further two. Other dioceses I know have thought about this and done it differently. And some of you here will have been recruited as a half-time rural dean from another diocese. But I think each of our dioceses need to think all this stuff through. The last thing I just want to highlight about capacity building is that it is costly. It is costly both in terms of finance and in terms of time and energy. In 2013, we will be spending more money in real terms on structures of oversight and support as a result of our deanery strategy than we did in 2006. And that's including having reduced our senior clergy staffing by one post. We now operate with two bishops and one archdeacon across the whole diocese, partly to account for the extra responsibilities held at deanery level. The hidden cost, of course, is the extra time given by area deans, deanery lay chairs, members of deanery leadership teams, which inevitably is often lost to parochial ministry. It's the monthly meetings the diocesan bishop now has with the area deans, the regular one-to-ones with them and the lay chairs, the gatherings we have together. I said we haven't created seven mini dioceses, but we have formed another space for leadership, management and conversation, and that is time and energy consuming. It's our experience that handing responsibility to deaneries requires upfront and ongoing investment. The benefits you are looking for are not efficiency or increased income, although maybe that will happen. They're better decisions, which actually will save money in the long term, and better supported mission and ministry locally. So, the conference theme, how is the deanery making a difference in God's mission? Well, I want to be clear and upfront that in our diocese, we do not expect our deaneries necessarily to be a kind of missionary unit. Our deanery strategy comes under the structures of oversight and support strand of our strategy, And let's be clear that structures serve mission. We believe that God's mission takes place where Christian disciples relate to those outside the church. We do see deaneries as a shape for management. Occasionally, there are times when the deanery, like the diocese and parish, needs to be a shape for compliance. Church business has its place. But as one of our area dean colleagues is keen to stress, we're not about church business, but the business of the church, the mission of God, and the growth of his kingdom. And that's the shift we've seen in the life of our deaneries. A few examples. Bristol South Deanery, 100,000 people south of the River Avon in Bristol, predominantly white working class, pockets of the highest deprivation in the south of England, not many, hardly any, parishes meet their costs of ministry through parish share. There's a high dependency culture. However, at Bishop's Council earlier in the year, an outgoing incumbent, off to take on a diocesan and cathedral role about 10 miles from here, talked about the change he'd seen in the 6 years he had been in the deanery, having come as a curate from a deanery north of the river. He said that 6 years ago, deanery chapter was a place where no one would talk about mission or growth for fear of how it would make other people feel, or for fear of being seen as showing off. People would shout at the bishop when he visited to talk about it. That was my first deanery chapter meeting. And there was a sort of general sense that we're all doomed. Now in Bristol South, there are monthly leadership training breakfasts on Saturday mornings for lay and ordained leaders. Mission and growth dictate the agenda for meetings. Clergy are open in chapter about their successes and failures. The deanery gets together to offer services for those seeking the Christian faith, sort of seeker services, and for major festivals at their biggest churches. And there's a really collegial feel, particularly in the chapter. This is a deanery that now sees its life in the light of mission, and they act accordingly. In Chippenham Deanery, or the Missionary Deanery of Chippenham, as they like to be known, or at least the area dean likes them to be known, which is one of our two smaller, in terms of population, and more rural deaneries, this summer they organised a deanery mission in the villages of the deanery called Flame of Hope, tying in with the Olympic Torch Relay and Jubilee. Thanks to the leadership of Andy Gubbins, who's a priest in charge of one of the Chippenham churches, but also half-time deanery missioner. He's here this weekend if you want to talk to him. They built really good community links, and it brought the small churches together in thinking about reaching their villages. We had some, when the Olympic torch came through Chippenham itself, Flame of Hope was in all the photos. It was excellent. And next summer, the deanery will have a mission again, this time in the town, in Chippenham. And this is a really good example of how churches from across a deanery can join together in mission. And finally, an example from the deanery I live in, City Deanery, which sort of basically goes from, if Bristol's a clock, 12 o'clock to 4 o'clock, so the sort of northern eastern bit. Now, this is a deanery with great diversity. There are 28 churches in 24 benefices, ranging from the white highlands of Redland and Cottam to the multi-ethnic inner city of Easton and St. Paul's, from the extreme deprivation of the outer estates of Southmead and Lockleys to the relative suburban normality of East Bristol, but it's not that simple. What we always heard, and what people in City Deanery always said, was that it was too big to do anything together. The churchmanships were too different. But as the deanery leadership sat and prayed and talked together, they weren't put off. They worked together with the deanery in a really consultative way and a creative way, an engaging way, to develop a deanery strategy in response to the diocesan strategy, to break what they called the cycle of decline. declining church numbers, leading to declining resources, leading to declining mission and outreach, leading to declining church numbers, and so the cycle goes on. Instead, the deanery strategy focuses on replacing that cycle of decline with a cycle of growth. Therefore, areas reaching out to the community, what can we do together, sharing between churches, giving generously, and deploying licensed ministers to support growth. And they're going through that deployment process finally now. And really across geographical, theological, and sort of something could call boundaries, they've come together for the sake of mission. The giving of this deanery to the diocese and parish share was in free fall prior to 2010. Since then, it's the only deanery that has increased its giving year on year. Now, that might say something about our overall situation. They keep generosity, and particularly financial giving, interestingly, within the churches and to the diocese and to other organisations on their agenda all the time. They're seeing sharing of ministers across churches and new initiatives for developing ministry indigenously in these outer estates. And they're making tough decisions about how and where ministers, stipendiary and non-stipendiary, are deployed. Why is this? Because they're focused on God's mission. This is the best approach for them. Would it be that we could all have the vision, the passion, the commitment, and the permission to start something like this for our deanery? I've just got a few questions for us, really around the area of I talked about the changing relationship when you go through a process like this, of the diocesan leadership letting go, of deanery leadership taking it on, and the kinds of responsibilities that we've thought about changing where they sit. So in your groups, well, maybe personally, just take a few minutes in quiet first to think through in your deanery the answers to these questions and in your diocese. And then if we can have a discussion about that at your tables, and perhaps we'll have 15 minutes doing that, and then a bit of feedback and any questions I will endeavour to answer, and hopefully we will be finished at 6. So these 15 minutes or so on these questions, and then we'll have the roving mic. Thank you.